Today on Movie World, as we review 50 Shades of Grey and Kingsman. Time for Movie Rollers. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And here's Dee as well.
Movie Rollers is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings, greetings.
Hello.
Hello.
Hot off the press of our Oscar reaction show.
Yes.
That was pretty heated discussion.
Yeah. I didn't know how much Yazdi hated Foxcatcher. I'll say it one more time so he doesn't.
Well, let's take a minute just because we didn't review that. And I just want to take a quick minute to talk about Foxcatcher because I loved the hell out of that movie. I came out of it not quite knowing what to make of it. But over the day or two that followed, it started to haunt me and it started to get under my skin and it started to bother me. And then I started to read about what really transpired in that, you know, on that estate back in, you know, the 80s, whenever it was that it all occurred. And I kept thinking back to the performances of both Tatum and Carell in particular. And just the movie really, I think you said it on the podcast before when we spoke about it, saying that everything was between the lines. And I think it was, absolutely. And that's why I couldn't get it out of my head, because everything seemed to have a subtext and a context to it that wasn't directly on screen. And so it really got under my skin. I loved Foxcatcher.
I agree with Joe. I didn't love it at the time, but it was one of those that the more I thought about it, the more I liked it. But whilst I was watching the movie, I was completely mesmerized by Steve Carell and Channing Tatum's performance. I just was amazed by this transformation in both of them. And I know that you can say it's the prosthetic, but like I said during the Oscar show, there's something very interesting about the way that the lines are delivered in this movie. And my only criticism was that I wish I had known more about Mark Schultz, the character, and how he ended up going from, you know, Olympian to the situation he ended up in when we start the movie.
Yeah, I just don't understand the purpose of the movie. And I think that's my issue. I don't understand why this story needs to be told. Because if you're going to provide some context to it or some subtext, or if you're going to say this happens because of repressed sexuality, or this happens because of, you know, being a very rich person who is smothered by your parents and you're constantly under their shadow, then I can understand it. But the movie is too scared to make any kind of a statement about anything. And so it just becomes a documentary about this happened, this person came, they stayed at their house, they stared at them, there was something going on there, and then this horrible tragedy happened. So I just came out of it saying, what? So what? What am I supposed to do with this information?
But don't you think, so I think, first of all, Yazdi, I'd recommend that you watch this really good documentary that came out maybe 12 years ago called Born Rich. Really good documentary about young kids who are born into privileged families. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And there's basically two modes that they go into. One is they work incredibly hard because they feel like they've got to prove themselves. Mm-hmm. And then there are the others that do nothing because they know they've got this wealth that's coming to them. I think it's important to show that here is a man who had nothing to do with the wrestling world, but decided that because it could give him purpose and recognition and increase his self-worth, he did it. He did it for really selfish reasons. But what he ended up doing was actually taking someone who was worthy of that title and helping them. So it's a double-edged sword for me. I think it's a really interesting story about the way that people behave.
Yeah, I didn't see it that way. I think what he ended up doing was far, far, far worse than helping them. Eventually.
But it's about him, I think. That's the key thing. It's not about the Tatum character.
For me,
it's not about the Mark Schultz character. It's about the
I don't think, I don't think it was a story that needed to be told in the same way that it was. It was more of a character study.
Yeah, so then tell me something about the character. I came away knowing nothing about Steve Carell other than he was very rich. Well, yeah, John DuPont, other than he was very rich and he had an oppressive mom and he had this weird fascination with wrestling, and for no apparent reason, he got these two brothers to come and stay on his estate.
And isn't then, that interesting?
No, it just it doesn't.
That's enough for me.
It's to me that seems so. Lots of weird things happen all the time. Why is this worthy of a 2.5 hour movie?
Because someone died at the end of it.
Yeah, people died. There's crimes which
and happen. And because there were Olympics, because the Olympics were involved. This is like an Olympic sport.
But tell me something more about why even the Channing Tatum character or the Mark Ruffalo character. I never understand their motivations. Why did why did each of them decide to do what they did? I think the movie is. I think what I found most offensive is the movie has a lot to say, but it's afraid to say it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you.
And so my point is, if then don't make that movie. Sorry.
Yeah, we won't resolve this one anytime soon, but. I mean,
our impromptu podcast of Foxcatcher.
Yeah, I say don't listen to Yasti, go see this film. You'll probably hate me for it because I think it is a difficult movie to like.
It's a very cold movie, yes.
Yeah.
But no, I would recommend people watch it, but I tell me then what to make of it afterwards, after you watched it. But anyway, so
okay.
On to
today
a different topic.
We are gathered to discuss
something completely different.
50 Shades and Kingsman, two very different movies, both very different from Foxcatcher too. So which one would you like to do first?
50 Shades of Grey. I'm dying to talk to you guys about this.
Okay.
This is when I hate that we can't talk about movies when we come out of them.
Yeah, I was feeling bad we didn't do a podcast sooner because I was ready to post all kinds of stuff on social media when both of these movies came out, actually, not just 50 Shades of Grey. But okay, so 50 Shades of Grey is based on the preposterously popular books by E.L. James by the same name. And it essentially tells the story of a young, naive, somewhat mousy girl called Anastasia Steele, who happens to run into a very wealthy, powerful, intimidating, charismatic man named Christian Grey. As their relationship develops, it becomes very evident to her that he is interested in sexual interactions of the harsher sort involving S&M. And it's essentially up to her to decide whether this is something that she should allow as being part of the relationship that she's building with this man. That's 50 Shades of Grey. It stars Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan as the two lead characters. And then amongst other big name star cast, Jennifer Ely as well as Marsha Gay Harden play the mothers of the two characters. The movie is directed by Samantha Taylor Johnson, based on the book by E.L. James and other writers who are also credited for this particular movie is Kelly Marcel. So what do you guys think about it? This movie's made like a ton of money.
Well,
and it's been and so much ink has been spent on it in terms of people writing for or against it.
Rashmi's kind of limbering up and flexing her muscles. She's like cracking her knuckles, ready to let rip with some thoughts here. So go for it.
So for me, this really was 50 Shades of Dismay, or rather Mills and Boone's R-rated. I don't understand.
Do you know what Mills and Boone's are, yes, by the way? Okay, because I don't know if it's just a very English thing.
It's an English, it's a Commonwealth thing, I think. England and any countries that England...
So Mills and Boone's, right, for those of you who don't know, was a series of romantic books, and they all had covers like... who was that famous bodybuilder?
Or the guy who's in the...
With the margarine, curly long hair.
The margarine commercial. Yeah.
No. You know, it always had some muscly man embracing a young woman who was half his size. So that's Mills and Boons. And they're all romantic stories. And, you know, generally they were read by women of a certain age. Anyway, I don't understand the big deal here because there's really no story. The plot is a means to try and get in as many scenes of erotica in as possible. And when the erotica comes, it's not mind-blowing. It is sexy, no doubt, but it's silly and it lacks bite, literally.
So, how do you follow that? I must admit, you know, I've heard a lot about the book. I haven't read the book. And by all accounts, the book is a terribly written piece of prose. I mean, I think the one thing that I've picked up about all the fuss about 50 Shades of Grey is it's a really terrible book that's almost impossible to get through if you have any kind of
intelligence.
If you have any kind of appreciation for well-written work, this is not for you. So why the hell is it so popular? And I think that question kind of fascinated me as we went into this movie. It's like, you know, well, there's something here. It's this cultural phenomenon. So, you know, let's check it out. Let's see what there is. And, you know, a movie is not necessarily the best way to judge a book, but.
Please don't say you bought it on your Kindle and read it, because you often do that.
Yeah, no, I haven't, because okay. I often do that, and I'll do that, especially if I enjoy the movie and want to kind of, but there was nothing here. I mean, you know, I didn't hate this movie. I think there's something about Dakota Johnson's performance here that there's an earnestness to what she does that really sells the movie in a way that would otherwise be a really terrible piece of filmmaking. And I think, you know, the problem I have with it is that the messages are all muddled and mixed. You know, this isn't so much about being sexy as opposed to being abusive, because there wasn't the sex in the movie wasn't sexy. The sex in the movie felt abusive to me. And, you know, maybe that's just a perception thing. And the only, you know, the other underlying message, and, you know, I kind of picked this up from a piece I read about it in The Economist, which is,
really, Joe?
They reviewed the movie, and so I was reading it, and they made. No.
Read about 50 Shades of Grey in The Economist.
I know, there's so many things wrong with that statement, but it's true. And the point that they made was that in some ways, you know, the message the movie seemed to be selling is that being a billionaire allows you to be creepy. And that's exactly what I took away from it. You know, here's a guy who's a, you know, he's got all this stuff around him financially, but he's essentially a really creepy, weird dude. And, you know, the fact that he's got lots of money seems to make that okay in some way. So we'll talk about the BDSM aspect of it, because that, I think, you know, it doesn't do a good job of, you know, if that's your thing, I get it, but it doesn't do a great job of that. So, Yasti, what did you think of this?
So I would start by saying I don't think it's a bad movie, but I don't think it's nowhere near being a good movie. And I think it fails on every one of the accounts by which it's gathering up so much of the controversy. So number one, it's horribly written. I mean, there are many examples of people who have taken not very good popular books and made good movies out of it. I mean, the first one which comes to mind is Clint Eastwood did an amazing job with Bridges of Madison County. I thought that's a great movie, but put that aside. So it's got terrible writing. The movie's about sex and it's really lame. I found all the material, all this, there's like so many sex scenes in the movie. And after a while, I was bored. I mean, my point is, if you're doing a movie about S&M, get in there. Okay. And this movie is too scared. It's an R-rated movie. What are you afraid of? There's more S&M content on any episode of, you know, Game of Thrones, or, you know, and there've been so many,
true.
You know, there's so many movies which have been made about, you know, abusive relationships, and the movie kind of shies away from that. And then the other thing which kind of surprised me was that literally, and I'm not just saying this as a figure of speech, in this movie, literally nothing happens. Nothing happens in this movie. People just meet, they have sex, they get on planes, they fly somewhere else, they come back, and then the movie ends. It's like, you know, I have to admit my ignorance. I did not realize this was part of a trilogy. When the movie ended, I think I said, come on, or something.
Yeah, I think you did. You were like, come on.
I said, come on, or something, because I'm like, no, you're not going to end the movie here. And then I realized, oh no, there's more to the story. So I think they could have taken this material and really elevated it and made it. I think fundamentally every relationship, no matter whether it's a sexual one, a romantic one, a parental one, a work relationship, every relationship is about inequalities in power. And any two people who interact at any level do some kind of a negotiation in terms of their power, where they sit in relation to each other. And when somebody demands more than what somebody else is willing to offer, that's where the fun stuff is. That's where conflict comes in. And there's so much to be made from this. And this movie kind of really shied away from it. So it came across more than anything else as a disappointment to me. But I didn't mind watching it.
I didn't mind watching it either, Yasti, and I think you're right. The conflict is so literal in this movie because it comes over a contract that's written, right? The issue I have, I wanted to address Joe's point about why is this such a big deal? So erotic fiction for women has been around for so long, mm-hmm. but it's been top shelf, you know, black lace novels. Don't ask me why I know this. It's been around forever. I think what this did is it made it mainstream and it made it okay for women to go into a regular bookshop and find a book that has erotic fiction in it, mainstream, without going to a top shelf and feeling embarrassed about it.
I mean, just to respond to that, I think there's a couple of things that I've read about why this became what it was. Number one, I think, was the ebook popularity, where, you know, people walking around with Kindles could suddenly get these books and start reading them, you know, in the playground while they're watching their kids, kind of thing. You know, the kind of
mommy and what an offensive term. What an offensive term, mommy porn. That's a really offensive term.
I don't know. I disagree with that, but okay.
I think it's a really, really offensive term that, you know, we're making porn for moms. It's really offensive to me. I think there's erotic fiction for women and it's erotic fiction for women. Don't call it mommy porn.
Okay. Well, that's a different conversation topic, but I think the availability of ebooks, number one, and number two, this apparently is based off of the Twilight movies. This is a piece of fan fiction. So I think the combination of those factors have kind of made it into more than it is, but.
And that's the inherent problem with the movie that I had. So I think the whole thing feels so forced and the characters don't act true to themselves. And the weirdest thing to me was Dakota Johnson looks like she's a 15-year-old schoolgirl playing dress up.
No.
So to really? Me, yeah, that's how it felt to me. Like she looked very young. And so it almost felt a little bit pervy and creepy, like one of you said. Given how smart the character is supposed to be, I mean, I think this is so mixed up. This comes across like young adult fiction. Versus an edgy adult film, not porn. And I think Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct just did it so much better in the 80s.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the casting. I mean, I, like you, Joe, I think if this movie works at all, it's entirely because of Dakota Johnson.
Correct.
I mean, she, you know, her character has to go through some really weird, you know, turns and, you know, as things proceed. And I think she brings a really good sense of authenticity. I think one of the hardest things to do on film or when somebody says action is to blush. And she blushes in this movie all the time. And she kind of really makes the audience feel what she feels. And I cannot wait to see not the sequel to this movie, but I cannot wait to see what Dakota Johnson does next. And she has impeccable comic timing. She was on a television show which got canceled a while ago. And she was so good with her comic timing there. So I think she's a really good actor and she is so invested in this and she makes it work. And, you know, she's naked all the time, but it never seems prurient. It never seems, you know, she really, I don't know, there's something about her which makes this movie work. And I think one of the main reasons why the movie does not work is with the casting of Jamie Dornan. I have not seen any of his other work, but he looks like a puppy trying to be a tiger. I mean, this character is supposed to be intimidating and impenetrable and somebody that women are irresistibly drawn to. And he has a dark secret and he won't let anybody touch him. This actor is incapable of conveying any of those things. So it felt for me like that actor was playing a little bit of charade to me. So I wish they had picked somebody with a little bit more edge. You know, I think somebody like Jake Gyllenhaal would have been good or somebody like, I don't know, somebody with a little bit darkness to them. And he was smiling through much of the movie as well. I mean, this is a very conflicted character. I haven't read the book, but supposedly. So I
think you own a copy.
No, I don't. I
think he was badly written. I mean, I think about the writing, but I think more. I hold the actor a little less responsible because, you know, some of the scenes were very clunky and it didn't earn the right to kind of put us in some of the situations that some of the scenes were trying to get across. So I don't hold him completely at fault. The biggest surprise to me, more than anything, for a movie that is, you know, generally aimed at a heterosexual women audience, I mean, this is, you know, what we're getting is how much of Dakota Johnson we saw versus how much of Jamie Dornan we saw.
Yeah.
Like,
so this is, you know, exactly.
For a movie that I thought was aimed at, you know, erotic fiction for women,
there's very little male nudity.
There's
almost none.
No glimpse of any of his man parts. There's lots of glimpses of her female lady parts. There is no sexual activity that she seems to get any enjoyment from. So it's like, who are they trying to target with this movie?
Okay, so I don't know what people will think when I say this. Okay, so clearly the two of you don't understand erotic fiction for women because it's every woman's fantasy.
To be tied and beaten up?
No. I think
to be flown around in a helicopter and
to bag a young handsome billionaire. But I think from a woman's perspective, I have to really think about this. I know.
Use your next words wisely.
It's not necessarily about seeing the man parts. Man parts are interesting, but they're not necessarily sexy. I think his bottom was shown a lot, which was very nice. His abs were shown a lot. But it's the act of what's being done to her that, in a way, I think, is the play on the what's more interesting to women, right? So women don't find... Of course, Magic Mike is interesting to watch. Watching a bunch of men take off their clothes is interesting and maybe titillating for some. But I think women's erotic fiction is always about what's happening to the character, not necessarily who's doing it to her.
Yeah, but the primary conflict in this movie rests at the sexual level, right? Do we all agree with that? That's what's driving this. And this movie is so coy about sex. It's for something which is about S&M. There is like one scene towards the end where he beats her 6 times and then she bursts out crying and walks out the door and never mind, I'll stop there. But really, that's what you have to say about S&M. So my point is, there is no PG-13 movie to be made about S&M, right? My point is, if you're going there, then go all out there and, you know, make... There's so much to be said about this. There's a great movie which is playing right now called The Duke of Burgundy, which I haven't seen, but it's really about this, you know, push and pull of power between two lovers. And it's supposed to be phenomenal.
I've heard it's very good. Yeah.
And the movie which I kept going back to while I was watching this was a film called Secretary, which opened up, which came out, I think, 6-7 years ago. It might have been Maggie Gyllenhaal's first movie, but it was Maggie Gyllenhaal and James Spader, and he's her boss and she's a secretary, and they get into this S&M relationship. And I think that movie should have been what this movie should have been. It's really about this negotiating of power where you're giving up, you know, who you are in the real world when you are in bed with someone and pushing the limits. And I think there's so much to be said for that.
And often, I don't know why I know this, but often in an S&M relationship, the person who's having the abusing done to them is the more dominant person, is often in real life the person who has the power, right, and is now being submissive in their sexual life. So... This just didn't make sense, but let's not forget it's you know, based on Twilight.
Well, I think the movie shies away from maybe some of the way that the book is written, and I think the book gets more into that. And mm-hmm. I think that's a problem that I have, if that, you know, the reason that this book became so popular is that it does bring the, you know, the BDSM lifestyle to the mainstream. This movie doesn't. It doesn't go there. It doesn't seem to touch it. It doesn't, you know, it seems to suggest lots of things with this playroom that's there, but none of the equipment in the playroom ever gets touched.
Right.
Never mind, like explored or, you know, used in a scene. They don't even like, you know, linger the camera on it for more than a second.
Yeah. And when Yazdi was reading the lines, I mean, literally, it's like, here's my playroom. Is that where you keep your Nintendo? I mean, with lines like that.
Oh, let's not get into the lines. And I don't know how you're going to bleep this out, but there's a line where he says, I don't make love. I fuck hard.
I know.
I mean, I was giggling. Everybody was cringing. Come on. No actor. I don't care if it's, you know, Sir Lawrence.
I'm cringing now.
Sir Lawrence Olivier could not make that line work. I mean, nobody can make
that
line
work. That's why I don't hold him responsible for the way the character.
No, I think another actor with a little bit of darkness could have done something with that. And then, you know, there is another line where, if you agree to be my submissive, I will be devoted to you.
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Yeah.
That doesn't mean anything.
I know. Okay, let's wind this one up. Joe, go ahead.
Can I just comment on the one other thing? So this movie is getting a lot of flack, and it's very controversial because people think that the movie is somehow defending abusive relationships, and it's defending men who beat women and keep them in their power and women who get bruised and all of that. And listen, I'm as liberal as they get, and, you know, I'm all for women's rights, and I'm completely against the abuse of women. But really, I haven't read the books, but if you watch this movie, at no point in the movie is he abusing her, I don't think, or she's never in a situation where she's being beaten up or being forced to do things she doesn't want to. At every point, she makes a calculated decision whether she likes this man enough that she wants to go ahead. So I think that whole bit of, you know, chest beating about this movie glorifying women's violence is a little bit misdirected to me. It feels that way.
I think if you don't apply the necessary level of intelligence to what you're saying, I think it can be a little dangerous in that regard. I mean, I think that's part of my problem with the movie is that it doesn't seem to be the one scene of the most graphic scene, you know, the one with the six lashes. doesn't seem to have anything to do with sex.
Right.
It is more about, you know, violence. And that, I think, is perhaps where some of the criticism is coming from, because for me, that wasn't really a very sexy scene. It wasn't, you know, I would imagine that BDSM is a very sexual, you know, ideal, right? That's what happens here. But that scene didn't seem to have anything sexual about it at all. And
well, also because it's completely eliminated the point I made earlier, which is in a submissive, dominant relationship, the power play is very different to how it would be in real life for those two people. So,
So wrapping it up. I didn't hate this movie. I mean, it's so hard to recommend. And like I say, the issue that I have with it more than anything is, you know, just he's a creepy billionaire and, you know, she's kind of drawn into his world. But not a lot else happens. And the issue about a movie with this kind of hype is that it's nowhere near as steamy as it should be.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reasonable chemistry between the two leads. But there's no passion here. There's no romance and there's no sexual excitement. It just seems to all pass by in black and white. So I'm going to give this a 50%, 5 out of 10, Shades of Grey.
Yazdi.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, I wouldn't recommend people not watch it. It's not horrifying. It's actually, you know, it's watchable kind of, you know, late night, back of the plane kind of movie. But it's such a lost opportunity to me. I think there is a need for people to make movies about power and sexual relationships and so forth. And, you know, there's a movie called Short Bus, which came out a while ago, and Secretary. And there's so many great movies on this topic. And so with all the hype and all the money and all the studio resources at their hand, it's a shame that they kind of ultimately backed away from the really edgy stuff in this movie. So ultimately it just becomes, you know, about stupid people with their stupid rich people problems. You know, I was just like, what's going on here? You know, it failed to kind of involve me at any level. 4 out of 10. Watch it, but don't expect anything much.
Yeah, I forgot to say, Yazdi, you know, Jamie Dornan was a replacement for Charlie Hunnam, who was the original who's supposed to be the original Christian Grey. I mean, with character names like Anastasia Steele and Christian Grey and phrases like later babes, I mean, I would save this one for later. So later that maybe you don't bother. I mean, I don't hate the movie. I didn't really enjoy it. It was so meh. I don't know. Yeah. 4 out of 10 as well.
I mean, oftentimes when, you know, we see a movie and I haven't read the book and I've heard that the book is popular, then I'll go out and do that. And I've done that like many times since we've been doing Movie Wallers. But I have no desire to even, you know, find out what happens next.
Yeah,
and, me neither. And that's kind of a shame because, you know, Hunger Games is one that, you know, I missed the boat on the book, picked up the book, enjoyed the heck out of it, read the trilogy. Gave it to Rashmi. You know, Wild is another book that I enjoyed terribly as a movie and tore through the book afterwards. And I was hoping that maybe I'd come out of this with, you know, understanding that there were two more books to, you know, have something to read, but it's just not, I have no desire whatsoever to, you know.
And it's written by a woman, it's for women, and it's made by a director. They went out of their way to make sure the director was a woman. And so.
And she's a good director normally.
She's a good director normally. So I don't know, was there too much pressure to keep it kind of blunt and boring and bland? I don't know. It's an R-rated movie. Go there.
No, I think that's the problem. I think they were too afraid. And I think maybe some talent was scared away from this movie because of the reputation of the book. I mean, it's not a very well-crafted story, it's probably has some well-crafted scenes in the book if it does really go there in terms of the S&M. But
yeah.
All right. Moving on, second movie of the week is Kingsman.
So Kingsman: The Secret Service is based upon the acclaimed comic book and directed by Matthew Vaughn. And Matthew Vaughn also directed Kick-Ass, X-Men First Class. And this story tells of a super secret spy organization that recruits an unrefined but promising street kid into the agency's ultra-competitive training program, just as a global threat emerges from a twisted tech genius. So this stars Taron Egerton, Colin Firth, Michael Caine, Mark Hamill, Samuel L. Jackson, Jack Davenport, amongst many others. And it's directed, like I said, by Matthew Vaughn and written by Mark Miller, Dave Gibbons, Matthew Vaughn, and Jane Goldman. So, Yazdi, what did you think of this one?
So I think Kingsman does to the spy movie genre what Guardians of the Galaxy did last year to the superhero movie franchise. It just injects it with ridiculous, silly giddiness, stupidity, over-the-top, fun to the proceedings. I really think that if you're going to, there have been movies about spies forever. It's the history of cinema. And if you're going to add to that, the only way to do it is to go gloriously over the top. And this movie consistently and constantly goes over the top. And I really like that in terms of its tone, it has a slickness about it combined with a tongue-in-cheek humor, which makes for a very fun, enjoyable experience. And I actually have seen this movie twice now, and I was amazed at how consistently clever it is. This movie is a winner for me, an all-out winner.
Joe?
Yeah, this kind of thing I think is very hard to get right, because if you go wrong, if you go with a spoof genre, you end up with Austin Powers, mm-hmm. and I think they deftly and perhaps intentionally steered well away from that. Despite the fact that you've got some of the same kind of jokes going mm-hmm. on here with the Samuel L. Jackson as the, as the bad guy. So they danced around, I think, a lot of potential potholes that they could have fallen into. And what you end up with is just a very stylishly, comically fun movie. And I think it was entertainment wall to wall. I mean, you walk in there and right from the outset, it feels like something special and it ends like something special. I'm surprised they didn't hold this back for summertime, because
I know.
This is an incredible summer movie, blockbuster, popcorn, multi-million dollar, revenue making opportunity that I think they completely blew by releasing it in February.
Yeah. Couldn't agree with you more.
Okay, any film that starts with the Dire Straits Money for Nothing is one that I want to watch. And as the movie starts, it had a very Indiana Jones feel to it, which I really liked. I think the phrase, Joe, you mentioned Austin Powers, this has been used a number of times, is that this is really like James Bond meets Austin Powers. But like you said, I think it's a bit more of that Shaun of the Dead smartness and cleverness about it. It's silly, stylish, urban, and fun. And I think the amount of care that's been taken to put this together isn't merited by a super smart or clever story, but it's really entertaining. And it's so tongue-in-cheek, and it's so well done. And they got some really big names to sign up. I really, really love this movie. I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, I mean, I like movies which are self-aware, and this movie is so self-aware. And I picked this up when I saw it the second time, is I like movies which recognize that they're a movie and make a commentary on it. So there's, there's a time where Colin Firth's character asks, Samuel L. Jackson, when he's invited him to his place for a dinner, and he asks him, do you like the old Bond movies? And, what do you think about spy thrillers? And he says, well, they're too serious these days, and I like the old fun ones. And it's kind of mythologizing a movie, and in a way kind of almost defending its own tone. And, literally the movie goes from set piece A to B to C to D, and each one of them could have been a filler, and not a single scene in this movie is a filler. Everyone has a cleverness about it. Somebody has thought about, well, how can this be different while still paying homage to, correct, you know, the Bond movies and stuff. And that's not easy, you know, the writing and just it's polished. It's really polished. This does not feel like a rough draft.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, you know, you took the words out of my mouth because, you know, honed to perfection, mm-hmm, is really what has happened here. It's just marvelously marvelous. Every line of dialogue seems to have, you know, the right tone to it. Every scene in the movie, you know, is choreographed superbly. I mean, you know, there's a scene which uses the music Land of Hope and Glory, mm-hmm, and it's one of the yes, most hilarious yes, set pieces, you know, that I've seen in a long time. And it that kind of thing is normally, you know, it's one joke that gets to play out over a couple of minutes, but I was belly laughing from the beginning, and it got more and more inventive as it went along until it ends in this, like, you know, mess of yeah, I mean, I don't even want to spoil it for people.
Yeah, but there's one thing I want to say, but it's a complete spoiler, and I want people to enjoy
but
that.
But, you know, the way that scene starts to play, you start giggling, and then you start chortling as you go along, and then you're belly laughing by the end of it. And again, that just speaks to the nearest thing to me, I think, is probably the Quicksilver scene from last mm-hmm, year's X-Men movie. Yeah. Where
in the kitchen, yeah,
in the kitchen, where, you know, time slows down and gets choreographed, and it's all done to music, and it's a visual treat. But, you know, that moment alone is worth the ticket price.
Yeah, I mean, the production of this film is terrific. I mean, the attention to detail and all of the thought that's gone into, like, the gadgets and this is better than a Bond movie, right? Like, we watch Bond movies because we want to see what new gadget they're going to come up with. And they're all in here. This has got some really exciting, fun things going on. And yes, we've seen some of them before, but everything's so stylish. The beauty of a film like this is that you can take someone like Colin Firth or Samuel L. Jackson, who have done some really interesting, you know, serious movies like The King's Speech. And then he stars in something like this and he's equally good to watch. And Samuel L. Jackson, he was hilarious. He absolutely nailed this. And the woman with the legs.
Yeah.
That's genius. I mean, I looked her up. She's actually from a dancing background. It figures.
I mean, the Sam Jackson character, I think, he's done something here that's new. I think...
With the lesbian, mean, or even
no,
other words?
No, just, no, like just with the way that character yes, comes across. Because... It's very easy to see that as, you know, again, I go back to Austin Powers, and, you know, very easy to kind of use the whole Dr. Evil, you know, type trope. But here, he's playing it straight.
Yeah, he's playing it straight. Yeah.
He's playing it straight, but it's an incredibly funny performance, but there's not a hint of a nudge, wink, wink behind it. He's like, no, this is how I think this character should be,
and there's logic,
and he sells it, and it absolutely makes sense right all the way through. So instead of being this, you know, kind of, it's been described in a couple of reviews as a very campy performance, and I don't see it as campy. He's played it like amazingly straight, but it's a hilarious performance of somebody that's got real quirk to them.
And I think it's interesting because he's got logic to the way that he behaves. Yeah. Like, and you can't argue with the logic, like, right? He's not evil, and people aren't generally all evil or all good. And that's what I think he's nailed really well.
Like, I was never really scared of him. I was just very amused by him, but I was scared of what he might do to the world.
Right, of course.
He was not the kind of person who's going to, like, you know, I don't know, put a fork in your eyes, you know.
Well, he's like a supervillain who doesn't want to see blood. That's a really, really interesting character, right?
Yeah. I did want to comment the one thing which really amazed me about this movie, and I think it's in line with this director, and he got into a lot of trouble with this with Kick-Ass, was he really has a thing for violence. I mean, there is no line which cannot be crossed when it comes to violence. And I think all of the reviews talk about it. There's a scene which is set in a church in Kentucky. And that movie just...
Sorry.
That movie just gleefully crosses all lines of propriety in terms... this movie, truth be told, should probably be rated NC-17 for its violence alone. It's so over-the-top violent. I mean, you think...
It's not dissimilar to the last scene in Django Unchained.
I know, but But my point is, because it's in this movie and where it's played for laughs... It didn't even bother me. I mean, I was, I mean, I, both times I saw it, people like when the church scene was over, everybody like took a deep breath, like, ah, oh, this is finally over. You know, it takes, we are so sensitized to violence that it takes a certain extra level to get to a place where people are like, oh, please make this stop now. This is too violent. But even that scene is choreographed so beautifully.
Yeah.
That it's
and it's smart. You can see, you know, I know Yazdi, one of your big things is when there's all that action and you can't see what's going on.
Yeah.
You can see everything, and even in the background, it was so clever.
Yeah.
I was looking for flaws, none.
Yeah, apparently he turned down the opportunity to direct X-Men First Class in order to do this.
Good for him. Yeah.
And you know, it's a project. I just looked up the book actually. He actually co-wrote the book. It's based on a comic book, so that's kind of you can see just how much he cared about this project.
Okay, let's wrap this up. So, Joe.
This is a Joe movie. I mean, this is my kind of fodder. It has a level of fun to it that works really well. Tonally, it's very consistent. And the nice thing about the way that they play this movie, they play it for laughs, but they play it. They have some serious moments too. So, you know, everything that kind of happened was a surprise to me as it went along. The plot kept me guessing, and just the beautiful choreography and stylishness of the movie won me over. So, gosh, an 8 or a 9, I'm going to have to give it. I'm going to go with an 8, but that's slightly stingy, and this is probably going to make my DVD collection.
Yes, D.
Yeah, I mean, like, as I started off, I think like Guardians of the Galaxy, this movie has the good sense to know that the one thing so rare in movies right now is fun. And it really, really to have a good, it's like being at an amusement park and coming out of a ride, just feeling content and feeling sated. And that's the feeling I had both times after seeing it. The movie is consistently clever and its climax is genuinely thrilling. When was the last time you saw a climax that actually thrilled you? I was thrilled. Like when people were running after you, I was like, come on, run, go. So, you know, I don't know. I think.
Start the engine.
Yeah, get the plane going. You know, I was really into it. So, you know, just top marks all around at every level. This is how you do a good, fun action movie. I'm so tempted to give it a 9 out of 10. I really want to give it a 9 out of 10.
So do it.
So I will give it a 9 out of 10.
Ooh.
I will. It's just, I don't know. It's fun.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Universal love. I love this movie. I would be a member of this club anytime. I hope the movie is set up for sequels. I got that feeling. I can't wait. I'm so hopeful another one comes. 9 out of 10.
Wow. Not bad.
Yeah.
And what the hell, honestly, Joe, like you said, what the hell were they thinking releasing this in February?
I don't know.
This should be released on the July 4th weekend.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's got a little bit too much of the London feel to it to maybe be targeted at mainstream.
Yeah, I was
American
a little bit
audience.
Worried that there was too much urban speak.
Yeah.
Not just urban, but English.
But,
you know, if the Peg and Frost movies can get big releases, well, I guess they're not that big here either, yeah. Are they? So. You know, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and what was it? The World Ends. I guess it's, yeah. You know, it's very easy to pigeonhole along with those kind of movies. But this is a blockbuster. I mean, plain and simple, this is a movie that could really, really thrill audiences across the summertime. So sad. Okay. Mail at movierollers.com. Let us know what you think.
Yeah, I think we should do. I feel like a 50 Shades wrangle coming. I feel one bubbling up.
I have
to beat one out of me.
Then go ahead. And yeah.
I'm not going to touch that. Joe, you can comment on that.
I just got it. So yeah, rengl.com. Just a quick shout out to our friends over at wrangle.com.
We are loving interacting with you. People are posting wrangles for us to wrangle back to, and once I figure out the technical limitations, I'll be happy to wrangle back, but some good wrangles coming.
Yeah, terrific. So Rashmi, you'll set up a 50 Shades of Grey wrangle.
I feel one coming, yeah.
Okay. twitter.com/movierollers, facebook.com/movierollers as well. Until our next episode, it's too many movies, too little time. Goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.